That's excellent. Okay, Rita, what about you? What's your song of the decade?
It's really difficult for me to have a song of the decade because I'm such a magpie and I'm so fickle, you know. And then I'll hear Rehab and I think, oh yeah, that really talked about this decade, because actually I think this decade was just kind of damaged, sometimes in a good way, but it was damaged, you know, a lot more than I think we were facing up to the damage a lot more. For me, it'd be more artists of the decade. And in that case, I would go for Kanaan, who's a Somali refugee, lives in Canada now, and he's a rapper. And he, as far as I'm concerned, has put Africa on the map in a very different way to some of, you know, my favourites, like Amadou and Mariam that I mentioned earlier on. He kind of gave the reality of Africa in all its damage and all its beauty, and continues to do so, and has made just huge strides.
Well, we're going to come back to Kanaan because he's big in so many ways, and in fact could be very big news in 2010, and many more people could hear of him. So don't take it personally. We're not going to play it right now.
That's
but
okay.
We're coming back to it. Now, Rav, what about you? What have you chosen for the song of the decade?
I chose a track that kind of took everything that came out of the Asian music industry and kind of put it up there and said, this is what we are. And that was Punjabi MC's Beware the Boys, which is, to everyone that speaks Punjabi, is Mundi Ata Bachke. So a song like that kind of, I mean, it originally came out in 1998, and when it came out then, I mean, it was playing in possibly every single shop, every single club, every single restaurant, Indian restaurant you could ever imagine. It was something that was just, you know, so everyone was like, wow, that's so genius, you know, just the way that Punjabi MC just made the actual track itself, from just simply putting a vocal, Indian percussion onto it, and stringed instruments, and kind of making that sound so tight. And then all of a sudden this bass line comes into it and you're just thinking, how did he do it? And then come on, nearly 6-7 years later, they start charting, you know, and nobody understands.
All right, well, let's take a listen. That is really catchy.
There you go.
Yeah, it's amazing. Really good. Gets your feet tapping no matter what.
Exactly.
Gosh, I sound old. I'm not. Well, in fact, this is going to make me sound older because I've chosen an album that kind of represents the noughties to me. And I've picked The Rising by Bruce Springsteen. Because when he released the album, it was after the Twin Towers fell in New York, and many reviewers out there kind of dubbed him the poet laureate of 9/11. And so there's songs like Into the Fire on the album about a lost fireman's widow, or Nothing Man about a rescue worker suffering from post-traumatic depression. And I think many of the songs on the album kind of touched a chord and expressed much of the uncertainty that the world was feeling post-9/11, kind of what you say, Rita, about damaged, you know? So let's hear a little bit of that. Can't see nothing in front of me. Can't see nothing coming up behind. Make my way through this darkness. I can't feel nothing but this chain that binds me. Lost track of how far I've gone. How far I've gone, how high I've climbed. On my back's a 60-pound stone. On my shoulder, half my. Okay, so that was Bruce Springsteen with The Rising. So it's funny, we've all picked pretty different sounding tracks, which says that there wasn't one kind of coherent sound of the noughties. But if we can kind of pick out a theme of what the noughties represented, what would you say it was, Arwa?
I think part of it is what you've just picked up on, actually, and what the medley that we listened to demonstrated, which is the tendency to mishmash or mash up lots and lots of different genres and maybe kind of like listen to them all in the same place, sometimes even on the same record.
I think music has kind of come a long way, because in the 90s I kind of think it just didn't really have anything to it. You know,
what do you mean, it all sounded the same?
It all sounded the same. I just don't think I mean, I come from more of an urban background. I listen to hip-hop, R&B. You know, I think hip-hop was great in the 90s. R&B kind of just lost its way. By the end of, you know, from 98, 99, there was just nothing going on on R&B. You know?
And Rita, you're nodding your head there.
For me, I think the main thing is that we are able to listen to music differently. It's not just the big guns there. We've got access to all sorts of music, and I don't have to go anywhere to find it. And I think that's had a huge impact on young artists today. You know, they're getting it from their parents' old collection, they're going on the net, they've got friends from all around the world. You know, we're very London-centric here today, but, you know, London is such a cultural melting pot that then you go home, you have a listen on the internet, and you listen to all sorts of things. And I think that's been one of the main reasons why we've had this sort of explosion in this kind of music that we listen to today, we have access to today.
I just wonder how much of that is down to, I don't know if you can call it kind of the playlist culture from our iPods, from Spotify, from different places on the internet. How much do you think technology has had an influence on this decade?
It's totally revolutionized this decade. I mean, in so many ways. For example, part of what Rita was just saying, the kind of immediacy of being able to access music. If one of us kind of comes up with an artist who isn't necessarily very commercial, who isn't necessarily very mainstream, anyone listening to this right now could go on there. You could go on Kayman's MySpace. You don't need to wait till 2010 to listen to him. And that kind of degree of accessibility, I think, means that people are going to experiment a lot more and that the mainstream will become a lot more about fusion.
The whole internet kind of revolutionised the way that we get music to us as well. You know, you don't have to wait a long time, or you don't have to go to someone to kind of educate yourself on new music. You can just type it into Wikipedia or something and start wondering about where someone's from, their background, why they're making the music they're making. And I think that has kind of led the way throughout the whole noughties and kind of what kind of sound you're listening to. You know, it's not just one thing now. You know, you have people in, you know, Japan doing hip-hop, b-boy, breakdancing. Yeah. And to tell you the truth, if I didn't see that on the internet, nobody would have told me about it. My friends might have said, oh, you know, Japanese people do hip-hop as well. I was like, yeah, right. But now I have YouTube that can show a little kid who's filmed his brother doing head spins and everything. And I'm like, yeah, he actually is over there. So I think YouTube, Spotify, all these kind of, even Napster, the early days of Napster, you know, was the way that I used to get music to, you know, I used to get music before the big hip-hop R&B DJs used to even play it.
So it doesn't have to be a big kind of commercial success anymore for you to know about it.
No, definitely not.
What about when it comes to music and politics, Rita? I mean, is the age of the political musician, is that over?
In a way, yes, because you don't get the big protest songs, you know, the big protest artists. But I think it depends on what you're listening to it and where you're listening to it. You might not find it straight away on the mainstream, but if you look at young African artists now, everything that they're singing about has to do with their condition, their social outlook, what's happening in their country. And actually, it's quite revolutionary in Africa because usually it's the elders who have a voice, not the youth. But because of hip-hop and they're kind of reclaiming that whole genre, the youth are speaking out. And what's more remarkable is that they're being listened to as well. So, you know, people like Gidi Gidi Maji Maji from Kenya, they put out a song called Unbogable during the elections a few years ago. And that became like the unofficial anthem of the country. You know, Unbogable, you cannot shake me. We know who we are. And, you know, the politicians had to listen and really kind of make their policies accordingly, you know, because people were actually scrutinising what they were doing. The same thing happened in Senegal. Okay, not quite so successfully, but they've got 3,000 hip-hop artists in Dakar alone. And those young people were making their voices heard. So maybe if you listen to the British charts, you might not hear it, and it might not be quite so evident. But if you go around the world, yeah, very much so, the youth, especially the youth, are speaking up and speaking out.
Is MIA a bit of an example of that as well?
Oh, yes. Well, RMIA, British-born, coming from Sri Lanka, but she's really got a very, very global outlook. And don't forget, her father was a Tamil Tiger, so she grew up in a very politicised household, and, you know, she's carrying that on, whether it's making music in Brazil or tapping into what the young people are doing in Angola with the Kuduru, and that she's in there. Really political.
It's quite interesting because you actually started off that answer by saying, in fact, there aren't as many kind of political anthems, but you've thought of quite a few, actually.
it depends on where you're listening.
Yeah.
You know, if you're listening to what's kind of just in front of us, the mainstream, but I don't drink from the mainstream, so...
On a more kind of everyday level, I've found that just the fact that artists aren't treated as novelties or, you know, niches because they might happen to have roots that aren't necessarily British is a healthy thing. I feel like in the 1990s, you know, there was a number of British Asian artists breaking through, but they were treated more as a trend at the time. That hopefully and healthily has kind of changed, and you've now got a mainstream that's much more representative, I think, across the board in terms of influence, cultures and so on.
Now, Rita, we started out by talking about one of your choices. Well, your choice, really, for the sound of the decade. That was Kanan, the Somali-born artist who now lives in Canada. And we're going to come back to him because, you know, we said if you hadn't heard of him already, and now everybody's probably looking up on MySpace and the rest of it, that you might soon, because his song is one of the contenders for the theme of the 2010 World Cup, and the song is called Waving the Flag. So we're going to play that out, but before we do that, I have to announce the winner of the pop quiz competition. Who do you guys think?
Oh, it'll be our...
Yeah, I think so too.
I saw that scribbling, I was just writing illegibly, so...
Well, in fact, it was Rav. You got 14 out of 17, right?
Jeez,
Rav!
Congrats. Do you get a prize?
You get a cookie and some love.
That's good enough.
Okay.
Invite me back.
Okay.
Oh, way to go.
Excellent. Okay, well, Rita, seeing as you introduced Kanan, why don't you introduce him out of the program and just say a little something about him.
When I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag.
This is the guy who has made hip-hop really real again. You know, the things he speaks about, he really takes it to the gangster rappers and says, you know, you think you know violence, you think you know you've got it hard, well, come to my neck of the woods, come to Somalia and see what happens there, what people have to contend with, and we still get up every day and we make it work for us. And he combines, you know, classical Somali records with samples of Bob Marley, collaborates with Mos Def and Chubb Rock. He's, as far as I'm concerned, a true sort of child of the world. You know, his reach, you know, just embraces the globe.
So many wars, settling scores, bringing us promises, leaving us poor. I heard them say, love is the way, love is the answer, that's what they say. But look how they treat us, make us believers, we fight their battles, then they deceive us. Try to control us, they couldn't hold us, cause we just move forward like buffalo soldiers, we struggle.
That's Kanan with his song Waving Flag from his album Troubadour. And my thanks to all my guests, Arwa Haider, Rav Patti, and Rita Ray. Now, if you were listening at home, how did you do on our music quiz? Well, you'll be delighted to hear that I've posted all the answers on our NewsHour Facebook site. And I've also asked, if you were to add to that list, which song would you pick as the sound of the decade? And for those of you who have not joined Facebook, you refuse to, that's it. Or maybe it was your New Year's resolution, you've quit it. We'll try to get the answers on our website, bbcworldservice.com, later in the day. We're going to turn from music to movies now, and a new British film opens this weekend in cinemas in the UK. It's all about the early days of one of the Fab Four, John Lennon. Nowhere Boy has been well received by the critics, but it may surprise some audiences by focusing not so much on Lennon's musical development with the Beatles, but more on his complicated family life in 1950s Liverpool. Vincent Dowd reports.
And that famous start to A Hard Day's Night is all the Beatles music you'll hear in Nowhere Boy. Instead, the story centres on the pre-Fab Four John Lennon, years spent mainly with the redoubtable Aunt Mimi.
How was school?
Killing us with homework. Maths, chemistry and that famous crowd pleaser, history.
Don't lie to me, John Lennon! Veronica Connor tells me she saw you on the roof of a bus. Without me, you would be in a children's home. Just remember that.
Like you'll ever let me forget.
In spite of all the danger.
The film portrays the very different Britain of more than 50 years ago. At its centre, the drama and tragedy running through the lives of the five Stanley sisters, including John's mother, Julia. Much of the story plays out in Mendips, her sister Mimi's house in the quiet Liverpool suburb of Walton.
Oh, I know, this chump came from Poland because he was here last night taking photographs in the dark.
Today, Mendips is run by the National Trust, more often associated with grand, stately homes. But for those guided expertly around by custodian Colin Hall, almost any detail of John's early life fascinates, such as hearing about his gang, the Outlaws.
The Outlaws were well named because one of the favourite games they liked was Cowboys and Indians. And where they would go is just over there where those trees are growing in the background, into the grounds of Strawberry Field. And, of course, it remained etched in his memory.
But even the biggest Lennon fans who go to Mendips are often surprised to see his background was not impoverished. Marcia Isabel is from Indiana.
He appears to be a little more affluent than I thought he was. This is very similar to where I may have grown up, maybe a little more affluent than where I would have grown up.
It's not like Elvis being dirt poor.
And I don't see him as being that disadvantaged. He had someone that really loved him, wanted to push him to do better.
The writer who had to master the Lennon family complexities was Matt Greenhalgh. He won much praise for his last script about Joy Division singer Ian Curtis. He says he learnt there that writing about real people, you will never please everyone who knew them.
I mean, I wasn't in any of the rooms when those things happened. The same like biographers weren't as well. Biographers say that they're an expert on, but they weren't really there. It's a very fine line to say, you know, how accurate things are. I mean, at some point, you know, you have to say, right, it is fictional.
In part, Nowhere Boy is based on the memoirs published by John's half-sister, Julia Baird. But she's now turned against the film, saying it misrepresents parts of family life.
Me and Mum have had a bit of a heart-to-heart. Yeah, she told me things about, Alf. Oh, and about you, funnily enough. Yeah, she said you stole me.
What on earth have you been telling him?
The film shows what happens when Julia, John's mother, alienates her own father by setting up home with another man, Bobby Dykins. Today, John's cousin Mike Cadwallader says you have to see the family tensions in the context of 1950s morality.
These are the mores of the time. He wasn't too pleased with the idea of John being taken off with another man, and he asked Mimi if she would look after John. Mimi, of course, jumped at the chance because she'd formed a bond with John then. And so when her father said, would you look after him, give him a stable home, because Bobby Dykins wasn't working in a bank or the civil service. He was a waiter, a nightclub chap and this sort of thing. The family at the time didn't think that was an appropriate environment for John.
Matt Greenhalgh says the film is really about the power of family.
It was always about the emotional contempt, this tug of war, the Mimi, Julia and John situation. It was always the